Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, July 21st. I'm Dagna, your reader for this next hour. We'll begin with the mini editorial, which was written this time by Diane Bostick of Sioux City. And Diane writes, "In order to achieve the best and safest outcome supported by the majority, parents, teachers, administrators, and board members at the local level need to be at the table when opening school decisions are made. I would hope the health and safety of the students, their families, and teachers would be the top priority." Again, this was written by Diane Bostick of Sioux City. Both the school board and the Sioux City Council met last night, and we'll have a couple of stories from each of those meetings. We'll start with the City Council. The headline is, "Sioux City Council approves settlement for water damage to the Orpheum and Downtown Library." The seating interior of the picturesque Orpheum Theater was not at risk of damage when water flooded the basement 5 weeks ago. The Sioux City Council, in a Monday meeting, approved a partial settlement of a tort claim involving a water main break that flooded the basements of the Orpheum Building and the Wilbur Elfs Library. A water main broke in the 500 block of Pier Street, where the Orpheum and the library are on opposite sides of the street. Wilbur Elfs Library was closed to the public at the time of the water main break and remains closed amid the COVID-19 pandemic. A target date of August 1st has been set to replace carpeting. Mayor Bob Scott said the repairs were quickly done and much more cheaply than in some instances of expensive damages that can take place when some basements get flooded. The break caused water to enter the library's basement, where the majority of the staff's offices are located. The cleanup efforts cost $13,459. Library Director Helen Rigdon previously told the Journal that the Mid-American Room, which is used for storage and also contains the library's high-voltage transformers, was inundated with 3 to 4 feet of water. Rigdon said extra desks and shelving got wet and had to be disposed of. 6 boxes of books, which were being stored for the Friends of the Sioux City Public Library's annual book sale, were also lost. Service Master was contacted to do the mud and water cleanup in the basement of the Orpheum Building. The firm worked for 3 days pumping mud and water, mopping and running air fans and dehumidifiers to clean and dry the area out. This will be a partial payment for the loss, as there remains a claim for some carpet replacement in one of the offices, city documents stated. Our second Sioux City City Council story is headlined, "Sioux City Mayor Says He Will Not Pursue Mask Requirements for Residents." In spite of believing it would be useful in stopping community spread of the novel coronavirus, Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott said Monday he will not ask the City Council to mandate that masks be worn in public places by city residents. Scott said, "It is a non-starter because the governor has already said you cannot." In an interview after Monday's council meeting, in which the wearing of masks came up in spite of not being on the agenda, Scott noted Governor Kim Reynolds has warned the leaders in local municipalities that they don't have the authority to require that residents use masks to halt the spread of the coronavirus. On July 14th, a day after Muscatine's mayor issued such an order, Reynolds said local officials need the governor's approval to implement such rules. Because Reynolds has a public health proclamation in effect, a local official can't implement requirements that conflict with the state rules, the governor said. So it would not be appropriate, and it is not in effect. Scott said the position by Reynolds is curious, because Republicans like her and other Iowans often say making decisions locally, sometimes called home rule, is a key ethic. "I am a local control guy," he said. The interview with Scott came after Jeanette Hopkins used the end of the meeting to urge the council to mandate mask wearing, because in a health crisis, those actions would save lives, Hopkins said the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have cited the gains in fighting the virus that could result with increased mask wearing. Hopkins told the council members, "I certainly hope this is something that will stay on your plate." The council members could not respond since the discussion did not arise as part of an agenda item. She added that Iowa school districts are seeking to safely reopen in August. That topic was discussed Monday in a separate Sioux City School Board meeting, and Hopkins said it would make the schools better designed to withstand the coronavirus if the city had a mask requirement. More than 3,400 people in Woodbury County have tested positive for the virus, and 46 people have died from COVID-19. Hopkins said it is unfortunate that the decision on whether to wear a mask has become politicized. At the council meeting of July 13th, Councilman Pete Greckin brought up that several people had told him a mask requirement would be a good step for the city. "I appreciate that people are wearing them. You should," said Scott, who added he wears them when entering stores. We'll now move to a couple of stories concerning this Sioux City School Board. Our first story headline is 3 Sioux City School Board members want strong enforcement of mask wearing during COVID-19. Whether the Sioux City School District will open instruction in the classroom or in online form when school starts on August 25th is still up in the air, although some school board members emphatically said they want wearing of masks on buildings and buses to be strictly enforced. Superintendent Paul Gausman in the Monday board meeting said he hoped district patrons have patience, that a decision on the form of instruction may not come until August 10th, later than he had hoped, because the ground keeps shifting in Iowa, where more than 700 people have died from COVID-19. Gausman said he expects numerous people would become upset by the requirement of mask wearing to get into buildings and onto buses. The discussion follows the wiping out of in-school instruction, plus spring sports and activities, over the last 10 weeks of the 2019-2020 year due to the coronavirus, which also resulted in businesses closing for weeks. All Iowa districts had to file return to learn plans by July 1st with the Iowa Department of Education. Gausman said the ultimate hope is to have instruction in buildings, but so far 21% of students who have registered for classes have asked to begin the year in online learning, which the district will allow for requesting families, as per the return to learn plan. While some Iowans debated whether individual school boards will be making the ultimate decision on moves that could endanger children and teachers as the number of coronavirus increases in the state, Governor Kim Reynolds announced Friday she would override local school districts and require students to spend at least half of their education time in classrooms. Gausman said the announcement by Reynolds on 50% of instruction being done in classrooms does not mean each individual pupil has to get half their learning in a school room, just that the entirety of all teaching to all combined district students amounts to 50%. School board member Taylor Goodvin has said Reynolds forgets a typical Republican position that local control of decisions is best. He wrote a social media post on that topic Friday. Gausman said 563 Sioux City School District teachers have signed up to take part in a remote learning training program. In another topic involving teachers, Gausman said it is conceivable some instructors who want to come off as the cool teacher to pupils may not enforce a requirement to wear masks in classrooms. He said such teachers would be corrected to the district position of requiring that masks be worn, although he admittedly said it is not fully mandatory. Gausman says students who do not wear masks will not be allowed into buildings or buses. However, some students in rare cases, including some special needs students, may have reasons to be excused from wearing them in classrooms. 3 of the 7 board members, Goodvin, Monique Scarlett, and Perla Alcoran-Flory, early in the discussion wanted masks or facial coverings required by teachers and students at all moments of the day. Gausman said he could be that strict if a majority of the board members came to that position, but a 4th member never did. Goodvin said, "I think masks should be mandatory when you are in the building. The benefits of wearing a mask outweighs any cons." Alarcon-Flory said she knew a few people who have died of COVID-19, which is why she wants strict enforcement of masks. Said Scarlett, "You need to be proactive and wear the mask to save the children of our district." Gausman said a big ongoing strand of work is to get students home without internet access lined up with that technology capability so they can take online instruction that may transpire. He said the Iowa Department of Education has $26 million to be shared by all districts for such internet connectivity costs. You will want to get that connectivity into the homes, Gausman. Our second school board story is headlined, Gausman his salary near $250,000. The salary for Sioux City School District Superintendent Paul Gausman is nearing $250,000 after approval Monday of a 2.25% raise in his pay and benefits package for the 2020-2021 year. The Sioux City School Board on a 6-to-1 vote approved a contract extension for Gausman. The board in recent years has typically annually approved a series of rolling 3-year contracts, with one additional year extending the expiration date each time. The new contract indeed covers 3 years, running through 2022-23. The salary for the current year will be $248,646. The board members had previously used a closed session to discuss the performances of the administration. The school board said that Gausman succeeded beyond their metrics, gaining a positive evaluation by the board in the 6 required leadership standards for Iowa school administrators. In a memo attached to the contract proposal, specific examples of Gausman's work included steps to implement new preschool and international baccalaureate programs, growth of the career academy with specialty courses, steps toward building a new Hunt Elementary School, and meeting with parent and community groups. The memo said, "Dr. Gausman exhibited strong response to the global pandemic for our entire organization, including thorough communication with all stakeholder groups." Board member Dan Greenwell voted against the contract, saying he could not support a section providing a severance payout of perhaps multiple years if the contract ends before 3 years. "It is awfully rich," Greenwell said. Counting insurance benefits, an annuity, and a car allowance, the total cost of Gausman's compensation package exceeds $300,000, according to a journal analysis. Gausman, who was the 2014 Iowa Superintendent of the Year, has been with the Sioux City District since 2008. Last year, the pay raise for Gausman was approved as part of the meeting consent agenda. This time, it was on the discussion agenda portion, where board members could directly comment, and extended questioning by Greenwell resulted in the conversation going on for 45 minutes. A motion by Greenwell to delay the contract approval to an August board meeting failed, and a second vote to approve it followed shortly thereafter at the 2-hour mark of the Monday meeting. One city resident, Chad Crestell, a parent who has been critical of the leadership of Gausman since last year, told board members he opposed the contract. "He is the most paid government employee in this city," Crestell said. A year ago, Gausman contract extension included a nearly 2% raise in salary, settling his annual pay to $243,175 for 2019-2020. In July 2018, with the Sioux City District facing tight finances, the school board accepted Gausman's recommendation to keep his annual salary at $238,523 for the 2018 to 2019 school year. And that is the end of the stories about the council meeting and the school board meeting last night. Our next story is headlined, "Volunteers Bring New Life to O'Brien County Pioneer Cemeteries, Primgar, Iowa." 3 years ago, Corbin Perman and other volunteers scrubbed lichen off of decades-old gravestones with toothbrushes and a cleaning solution. They've since found a labor-saving cleaner that requires no scrubbing, just a spray-on application. Cleaning the gravestones in O'Brien County's Pioneer Cemeteries of lichen and dirt may now be much easier, but there's a lot of heavy lifting yet to do for the volunteers, who are bringing new life to small cemeteries that date back to the 1800s. Part of it's just determination to get it done. "It's starting to look so nice, you have to get them done," said Perman, a member of the O'Brien County Cemetery Preservation Association. The group formed in 2017, thanks in part to the late Dan Wetherell, the former Sutherland Library director who loved to explore cemeteries. "I just think Dan and I both had a passion for it," said Nancy Hill, the current library director, whom Wetherell often recruited to accompany him on his expeditions. A cousin who lives in Clinton County told Hill a group there that had formed to preserve old cemeteries received an annual appropriation from the county board, and the idea quickly took root in O'Brien County. So, with a few thousand dollars each year from the O'Brien County Board of Supervisors, plus some private donations here and there, The preservation group has undertaken its mission to clean, repair, and level dozens of stones in six pioneer cemeteries. Defined by state law as a cemetery that's had 12 or fewer burials in the past 50 years. It is up to the Board of Trustees in the township in which a rural cemetery is located to maintain it. For most boards, periodic mowing is about all they can afford. That's where the preservation group comes in. Using the money received from the county, the group has begun to fix stones and straighten those that had begun to lean after more than 100 years in the ground. They've hired a monument company to perform some of the work. They've also brought in experts to teach them how to level and repair stones, enabling them to stretch their county appropriation. That newly gained knowledge enabled the group to complete stone repairs and leveling in Randolph and Stewart cemeteries last summer. Work continues at other sites, especially at Covey Church Cemetery east of Primgar. Hill said, "We wanted to make that the showcase of what this group could do. Of the 40 stones there, only three did not need some type of repair. A Spencer, Iowa monument company fixed 11 of them this summer. Also yet to be completed this summer are placement of highway signs directing travelers to the cemeteries. The Covey Church and Center cemeteries will be the focus next summer. Association President Maury Radke estimated 90% of the stones at Center Cemetery are either broken or leaning. At some point, the condition of stones at Highland Township Cemetery, the largest of the pioneer cemeteries, will be addressed. They've been cleaned, but little else. Association members know that it will take time to spruce up all the cemeteries." When we resort to our own volunteers, it can be a multi-year project, Radke said. Hill said it's important that the restorations be done correctly rather than rushing through them just to get them done. "I think the goal is to do it slow and do it right so we don't have to go back in 20 years and do it again," Hill said. "The pace of work is quick enough that local residents have taken notice." Radke said the group has received compliments for the improvements, which led to the O'Brien County Veterans Affairs Office including the Pioneer Cemeteries this year when placing markers at veterans' graves for Memorial Day. Born and raised in Sioux City, Radke said she has no ties to any of the cemeteries or the families buried in them, but it's important, she said, that they're preserved to respect and honor the past. "Even though I don't have any family in these, I can connect with someone who does," she said. The headline for our next story, SBL files another legal challenge to county road funding. The Sergeant Bluff Luton School District has renewed its claim that Woodbury County's plan for funding $10 million in improvements to gravel roads is illegal. The school district last week filed a second petition in which it asks that a judge annul the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors' actions to use tax increment financing. The lawsuit is similar to one filed earlier this year after the board had adopted a bond resolution to buy the gravel. The county had amended the roads plan in an effort to appease the district's objections that led to the initial lawsuit by specifying which rural streets would be included and traffic counts showing why they should be on the improvement list. The county board approved the plan on July 7th and voted to issue the $10 million in bonds to fund the project. The school district responded with its latest petition, filed July 13th in Woodbury County District Court. In it, the district said the amended area does not meet the definition of an economic development area, and because of that, the rural roads project does not constitute an urban renewal project, and the board can't legally issue bonds. County Board President Matthew Ong said Tuesday he had not seen the petition, and to his knowledge, the county had not yet been served with a copy of it. He said he was surprised with the school district's renewed legal action. Ung said, "Right now, they're standing in the way of substantial infrastructure project in the county." The school district filed a petition in January asking the judge to strike down the county board's December 17th adoption of a bond resolution and void the board's action to use tax increment revenues to finance a project. The district said that the county acted improperly when approving the bond resolution and also failed to meet other requirements. The funding mechanism also should have been subject to a public bond election, the district said. That case is scheduled for trial in January. The county intends to use the $10 million to buy an estimated 2 million tons of gravel that would be applied to nearly 800 miles of roads in the next 5 years. Rural residents have raised concerns about the condition of county roads, saying that the gravel layer on many of them is too thin to support heavy agriculture equipment and they become sloppy in wet weather. To repay the bonds, the county would use tax increment financing generated from property included in the Grow Woodbury Urban Renewal Area that includes a large portion of the SBL school district. The so-called TIF funding is used by governments to divert increased property taxes from new construction to pay off money borrowed by issuing bonds to pay for public improvements that spur economic development. Woodbury County established the Urban Renewal Area in 2010. The area has been expanded since then, including a 2013 addition that included CF Industries' $2 billion expansion in the Port Neal Industrial Area. CF's expansion, completed in 2016, has significantly increased the school district's property valuation base and potential for TIF funds generated within the urban renewal area. SBL district representatives have said at previous county board meetings that it is not equitable to spend money generated from an urban renewal area that covers only a portion of the county to fund countywide improvements. We'll now have time for a few of the news briefs. Sioux City man charged with setting fires. A Sioux City man has been charged with setting a July 12th fire that damaged a garage and car at a home that is under construction. Howard Wannon, 45, also has been accused of setting fire Sunday that caused minor damage at Pulaski Park. Wannon was arrested Sunday on charges of second-degree arson, first-degree criminal mischief, and two counts of third-degree arson. According to court documents, Wannon took wood at a job site in the 4600 block of Peters Avenue, put it into a trash can that already contained paper and other construction material, that moved it next to an overhead garage door and set it on fire. The fire damaged the overhead door and damaged siding on the garage and house, and a 2017 Buick LaCrosse parked inside the garage. The damage was estimated at more than $10,000. Wannon is charged with setting fire to the contents of a garbage can at Pulaski Park, 2400 Vine Avenue, at 2:11 p.m. Sunday, and destroying the garbage can. According to court documents, Wannon also placed a wooden pallet against a storage shed door at the park. Witnesses saw him trying to ignite the pallet. Damage to the building was minor, court documents said. DNR investigates fish kill in Buena Vista County, Elbert City, Iowa. A manure storage tank leak is the likely cause of a fish kill in Buena Vista County, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources reported Monday. DNR staff met with Chris Ehlers near Elbert City on Sunday to investigate the release after Ehlers reported that a valve on the tank had failed and released an unknown amount of manure that had pooled near the tank and run into grassed waterway. The DNR found a few dead fish, manure, and elevated ammonia levels throughout 4 miles of a tributary of the North Raccoon River. After checking for other pollution sources, DNR staff concluded the cause was the manure released from the Ehlers farm, possibly through underground tile lines. The DNR is monitoring the cleanup and will consider appropriate enforcement action. Tyson Center to host Hump Day Happy Hours. A five-week Hump Day Happy Hour with live music, food trucks, and bar service will take place every Wednesday from July 29 through August 26 at the outdoor plaza of the Tyson Event Center, 401 Gordon Drive. Presented by the Saturday in the Park Festival, the event will run from 5:30 to 7:30 each Wednesday, with proceeds benefiting local nonprofit organizations. A live music lineup will include Ultra Violet Fever on July 29th, Emily Johnson August 5th, Dane Lewis August 12th, Ghost Cat August 19th, and Noah Towns and the Other Brothers, August 26. Ticket reservations will be required. To assist with social distancing, only tables will be sold for each week's performance. 20 seated tables or four or six people and 18 cocktail tables for two people are available. For more information or to reserve a table, go to TysonCenter.com. Semi-truck show to benefit Nyland Cancer Center, Sanborn, Iowa. The 7th Annual Commercial Chaos for a Cure, a benefit to raise funds for the June E. Nyland Cancer Center, will take place this weekend in Sanborn. A partnership with the Tri-State Chapter of the American Truck Historical Society, Commercial Chaos for a Cure, will include a truck pull, pickup pull, and burger feed at 5 p.m. Friday on Prophet Street. A bobtail semi-poker run begins at 9 a.m. Saturday with a route that begins in Sanborn before going to Sheldon, Sioux Center, and Hull, and then heading back to Sanborn. There will also be a Yesterday Memories and Truck Museum, a pulled pork dinner, and a raffle on Saturday. Commercial Chaos for a Cure was started after organizer Paul Schelling, the owner of a trucking company, was diagnosed with stage 2 cancer when he was still in his 20s. Once in recovery, Schelling and his friends and family wanted to spread cancer awareness. Funds for this year's events will go towards advancing the technologies cancer patients need for treatment. We'll now move to a COVID-19 update for the Siouxland area. 33 more Metro Sioux City residents have tested positive for COVID-19, state and county health officials reported Monday. Woodbury County led the way with 14 new cases of the respiratory disease, followed by 12 more cases in neighboring Dakota County. There were 4 more cases in Plymouth County and 3 more in Union County. The number of cases in Dixon County was unchanged. As of Monday evening, 3,480 people in Woodbury County had tested positive for the virus, the second most in the state behind the state's largest county, Polk, which had 8,450 cases, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Of the Woodbury County cases, 3,143 are considered recovered, according to the Siouxland District Health Department. A total of 100 new cases were reported in the county Monday, for a positivity rate of 14%, according to the county department. Siouxland District Health Department, or SDHD, also revised upward to 25 the number of new cases reported on Sunday. The state database was not updating fully over the weekend because the new cases and new test results reported for those days are now showing higher numbers than they were when they were originally reported. As of Monday, Dakota County's confirmed cases of the virus stood at 1,842. Of the 93 counties in Nebraska, that's the third most, behind only the two most populous, Douglas and Lancaster. The Dakota County Health Department does not report new coronavirus infections on the weekends, so the total new cases reported Monday were for the last 3 days. Ricketts defends Medicaid time frame. Nebraska residents who qualify for expanded Medicaid under the federal health care law can start enrolling next month, Governor Pete Ricketts said Monday as he defended the state's nearly 2-year time frame to offer coverage after voters approved it. Ricketts said Nebraska will open enrollment on August 1st and coverage will begin as scheduled on October 1st. The rollout begins nearly 2 years after Nebraska voters approved a measure to expand Medicaid coverage in the November 2018 election over the objections of Ricketts and conservative groups. Nebraska lawmakers and governors repeatedly rejected attempts to expand coverage, prompting a statewide ballot campaign that won with 54%, mostly from the Omaha and Lincoln areas. The unusually slow implementation has drawn criticism and lawsuits from supporters of Medicaid expansion, which will cover an estimated 90,000 low-income adults in Nebraska. Supporters argue that the nearly 2-year wait since the election left many residents in limbo as they waited for coverage. They also say Nebraska lost out on federal matching dollars that the state would have received with an earlier implementation. Ricketts defended the implementation period at a news conference to announce the enrollment date, saying he wanted to avoid the fates of states, including California, which enrolled more than 366,000 people who were not eligible. State officials took their time to ensure that we're putting the people who are supposed to be in the program in there and not the people who don't belong there, Ricketts said. Nebraska Medicaid Interim Director Jeremy Brunson said the state has hired an additional 68 employees to help determine whether applicants are eligible for coverage, plus another 55 call center agents who will help process claims. Brunson said he expects to be able to launch the program without further delays. He said, "We feel very confident that we're in a great position to process applications." Once in place, the expansion will cover adults 19 to 64 who earn up to 138% of the federal poverty level, about $17,600 a year for one person and $36,150 annually for a family of four. Some of the skepticism in Nebraska stems from Republicans' long objections to expanding Medicaid under the federal health care law championed by Democrat former President Barack Obama. Medicaid, which provides health coverage for lower-income and disabled Americans, is funded jointly by states and the federal government. The 2010 Affordable Care Act encouraged states to expand Medicaid by promising that the federal government would cover most of the cost. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, July 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Marlene Molly Bover, and that's spelled B-O-E-V-E-R, 78 of Lamar's, died Friday, July 17th at home. Private family graveside service will be Thursday in Calvary Cemetery, Sioux City. The Reverend Bruce Lawler will officiate. Visitation with social distancing and wearing a mask will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the Wexwinkle Funeral Home in Lamar's. Expressions of sympathy can be extended to the family through www.wexwinklefh.com. Marlene Teresa Bover was born on March 27, 1942 to Herman and Lillian Bover in Remsen, Iowa. She was raised in Remsen area and graduated from Remsen St. Mary's High School. Molly worked at Archie's Wayside for many years in various positions. As a bartender, when she saw a regular customer walk into the bar, many times she would have their favorite drink in front of them before they even sat down. Many of her customers became her best friends. When she retired, she was able to really enjoy and cherish those friendships. Her generosity toward family and friends was unparalleled. She was always paying for meals, giving gifts, expressing her concerns, and donating to numerous charities. She was a member of St. James Parish and an avid fan of the Chicago Cubs. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be made in Molly's name to a charity of your choice. Patricia Ann Fosbett Oxendale, 65, of Ida Grove, passed away Friday, July 17th at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Because of the current health conditions, private services will be held. All are welcome at 11 a.m. Friday at Bluffview Cemetery, Vermilion, South Dakota, for prayers and burial. Masks are recommended. Arrangements are under the direction of Hanson Funeral Home in Vermilion. Condolences may be sent online to hanson-funeralhome.com. Pat was born on August 9, 1954 in Canton, South Dakota, moving with her family to Vermilion in 1965, where she attended Vermilion Public Schools until her graduation in 1972. After high school, Pat entered the workforce through the DECA program, where she learned to become a dental assistant. She continued her education at the University of South Dakota to become a speech-language pathologist. Work in the public schools of South Dakota continued until she went on to become a reading recovery teacher leader, completing training at Texas Women's University in Denton. As a teacher leader, she worked tirelessly with struggling beginning readers, training teachers, and providing ongoing professional development for Northwest Area Education Agency. Pat was married to Jim Oxendale in Vermilion on September 21, 1996. They resided in Ida Grove, Iowa, and worked in the Iowa education system. While Pat and Jim had no children, their fur family of Irish wolfhounds surrounded them over the years. Pat loved travel and broadened Jim's experience visiting France, Italy, Germany, England, Scotland, Ireland, Hungary, New Zealand, and Canada. Perhaps her favorite place was Churchill, Manitoba, Canada, where she viewed polar bears, beluga whales, and the Northern Lights. Lanita R. Van Rokel, Sheldon, Iowa, 77, died Saturday, July 18. Service will be July 23rd, 10:30 a.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Hospers. Burial will be Sheridan Township Cemetery in Boyden. Visitation will be July 22nd, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the church. Ullman Funeral Home Hospers in charge of arrangements. Marguerite L. Herbold, Mobile, Iowa, 99, died Sunday, July 19. Arrangements by Johnson Ernest Funeral Home, Kingsley, Iowa. Laura Lori Baker, Kingsley, 88, died Monday, July 20th. arrangements by Rhodey Funeral Home in Kingsley. Galen D. Combs, Sioux City, 68, died Sunday, April 12th. Memorial service will be July 25th, 11 a.m. at the Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Daryl E. Pluger, Elk Point, South Dakota, formerly of Sioux City, 68, died Saturday, July 18. Celebration of life will be July 23rd from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Waterbury Funeral Services of Sioux City with military rites. Ed J. Denbasti, 66, of Sioux City, passed away Friday, July 17. Private services will be held. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. today with family present 5 to 7 at the Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Online condolences may be directed to meyerbroschapels.com. Ed, the son of Edward and Elvina Kempers Denbasti, was born on September 29, 1953 in Orange City, Iowa. He graduated from East High School in Sioux City. He earned a degree in economics and business administration from Morningside College and later completed his MBA at the University of South Dakota. Ed married Patty Swanson, the absolute love of his life, on July 21, 1979 in Sioux City. Ed worked his way through college at KTIV and began his career there after getting his degree. He then started in the banking industry at First National Bank in Sioux City. From there, he became the senior vice president of St. Luke's Health Foundation, worked in strategic development at IBP, and eventually returned to banking at First American Bank, where he served as market president. The culmination of his career was establishing the presence of Great Western Bank in Sioux City and serving as the market president. Ed was passionate and active in the community in Sioux City. He was on the board of the Boys Club and Sunrise Retirement Community and was a member of the Optimist Club and Downtown Rotary. For many years, he selflessly volunteered countless hours as treasurer of North High Band Parents and Sioux City Mariners Swim Club in support of his kids. He was also a longtime active member of Trinity Lutheran Church. Ed enjoyed being a recreational pilot in his younger years, watching and playing golf, vacationing in the Black Hills or at the beach, and drinking good bourbon with his sons. He enjoyed attending Kansas City Chiefs games with his family, and most importantly, spending time with his kids and grandkids and goofing off with his lifelong best friend, Dave Pratt. Ed was humble, kind, hardworking, funny, genuine, intelligent, easygoing, and incredibly loving. He was a beautiful soul who was dearly loved by his family and friends. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Trinity Lutheran Church. Elmer Frank Moss, 96, of Remsen, passed away Saturday, July 18, at the Good Samaritan Society in Lamars. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday at Christ Lutheran Church, LCMS, in Remsen, with the Reverend Garrett Casper officiating. Burial will be in Remsen Community Cemetery. Visitation with family, keeping to social distancing restrictions, will be 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at Fish Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen. Viewing will resume 1 hour prior to the service Thursday at the church. If you are unable to attend, you may send condolences and watch the funeral online at www.fishfh.com. Elmer was born on September 8, 1923, on the family farm near Remsen, the son of Frank Arnold Moss and Marie Catherine Erickson. Elmer was baptized and confirmed in the Lutheran faith at Christ Lutheran Church, where he was a lifelong member. He attended Remsen County School, too, in rural Plymouth County. He was united in marriage to Alma Garrels on December 17, 1946, at Christ Lutheran Church in Remsen. They enjoyed 71 years of marriage prior to Alma's passing in April of 2018. His love for the farming life was evident in his care for the land and his livestock. He also enjoyed bowling on several teams through the years, fishing, playing pinochle with his friends, watching and listening to all the Hawkeye games, and attending his grandson's baseball games and track meets. Dad was a very kind and humble man who always saw the best in each person. He instilled a work ethic in his children and grandchildren and to always do their best. Memorials in Elmer's name may be directed to Christ Lutheran Church in Remsen, Iowa, at SIDS Foundation, and the Hospice of Siouxland. Milton Brainerd Jr., Woodbury, Minnesota, formerly Sioux City, 78, died Monday, July 20th. Service will be July 23rd, 10:30 a.m. at the Holy Cross Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Sioux City. Burial will be at the Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be July 22nd, 4 to 8 p.m. at the Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. That concludes today's obituaries. I will now move to the opinion page, and we have a Tuesday topic, which is written by Al Giese, who is the co-owner, manager of Milford, Iowa-based Prairie Feed and Trucking. And his topic is Growing Climate Solutions Act. And he writes, Iowa's farmers and agriculture communities and the clean energy industry have all been devastated by the COVID-19 shutdown. We need some real leadership in Washington if we are going to get clean energy workers back to work while supporting the economic recovery for agriculture producers, as well as the rest of our nation. That's one reason I was pleased to see a bipartisan group of senators introduce the Growing Climate Solutions Act. This bill would help many of the farming communities I work with, while at the same time advancing agriculture sustainability. The fact that it has the support of environmental organizations as well as national agriculture groups like the American Farm Bureau Federation, National Corn Growers Association, American Soybean Association, and National Pork Producers Council should speak loudly to all members of Iowa's congressional delegation. The Growing Climate Solution Act creates a certification process by which the USDA can solve technical barriers to entry for farmers and forest landowners to participate in the private, voluntary carbon credit markets. This legislation establishes a program which would provide transparency, legitimacy, and the certified endorsement of third-party verifiers, allowing private landowners and farmers to generate carbon credits through a variety of smart agriculture practices. By developing and managing a process-oriented USDA website, certifying technical assistant providers, and certifying third-party verifiers, farmers who voluntarily opt into the pre-existing carbon credit market may easily, safely, and securely participate in this market. This bill is a welcome development considering the absence of support for clean energy industries and jobs in its legislative response to the COVID-19 shutdown so far. Considering the impact clean energy has on our environment and our economy here in Iowa, particularly with Iowa being a leader in biofuels and wind energy, this should be a top priority for our elected officials. By supporting the Growing Climate Solutions Act, alongside over 40 farm and environmental groups and corporations, and getting it passed in the Senate, Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst would be helping Iowa and the nation. I encourage them to focus on doing just that. Again, this was written by Al Giese, who is the co-owner and manager of Milford, Iowa-based Prairie Feed and Trucking. And we have two letters to the editor today. Our first letter is written by Judy Plank of Lamar's, and Judy writes, in the midst of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. Congress is currently debating a $740 billion 2021 National Defense Authorization Act, which allocates funding for the military for the coming year. Since the beginning of the current administration, about $100 billion more has been added to war and war preparation funding as funds for diplomacy and domestic spending, such as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, have suffered decreases. Due to the worldwide pandemic, the UN Secretary General has recently called for a global ceasefire. He stated, "The fury of the virus illustrates the folly of war. It is time to put armed conflict on lockdown. Put aside mistrust and animosity. Silence the guns, stop the artillery, end the airstrikes, end the sickness of war, and fight the disease that is ravaging our world. That is what the human family needs, now more than ever. Tell our senators to support the amendment to the NDAA that would reduce the military budget by 10%, or $74 billion, and use the funds for getting us through this pandemic." Again, this was written by Judy Plank of Lamar's. Our next letter is written by Maria Runquist of Sioux City, and Maria writes, "I am really concerned at the COVID-19 number rising each day. not just in our state, but all of the United States. We are leading globally for most positive tests and deaths. It is very sad that President Trump is not taking this virus seriously. He is undermining his expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the CDC, and all of our medical experts. Our president still refuses to acknowledge the COVID-19 realities. Instead, he is facilitating the increase in the virus by opening our schools, putting our children at risk. Mr. President, we are moving to more deaths and the catastrophe of more damage and suffering in our country. The president seems just to care about the health of our economy. He doesn't show care about the health care or well-being of citizens. The president is risking the lives of citizens to get another term in office. Since day one, it seems, we knew that. He didn't have the ability to lead our country. I am asking all citizens to whatever beliefs or political affiliations you have, vote this president out of office on November 3rd. Show that we are not fools. Life is beautiful. Again, this was written by Maria Rundquist of Sioux City. I'll now move to the sports page, and we'll do Terry Hersom's column, which is headlined, Hubbard Park Features a Great Fast-Pitched Legacy. There are still countless echoes from the past and innumerable memories that grow better with each passing year. For nearly two full decades, however, the iconic Sioux City Sports Venue at 2800 Jones Street has become a lonely piece of history, reduced to serving as an occasional youth league baseball team. There was a time, of course, when Hubbard Park was home to some of the finest men's fast-pitch softball in America. And a roundtable discussion at the Sioux City Public Museum last week was a fitting forum to commemorate Hubbard's 80th anniversary. Tucked into a residential neighborhood with mixed emotions toward its bright lights and crowd noise, Hubbard was first opened in 1926. But it was on July 15, 1940, that a grand reopening drew an overflow crowd of around 4,000 to see the initial games on a reconfigured field. The old center field became home plate, and the diamond fit perfectly into the property's natural bowl, where the park's steep concrete bleachers created an amphitheater effect. From that day forward, the diamond went from northwest to southeast and became home to the city's elite teams. You kind of had to earn your way into playing at Hubbard Park, said Ron Amick, an impressive gathering organized by Sioux City native Delbert Christensen, now a veteran Eastern Iowa girls softball umpire who makes his home in Cedar Rapids. We started at Gilman Terrace and then went up to Morningside, but the eventual goal was to play at Hubbard Park. It was Amick, a contractor by trade, who helped make Sioux City one of the nation's fast-pitch hotbeds, overseeing the construction of Penn Court Park in the early 1980s. That two-diamond complex south of the city limits, which no longer exists, hosted the International Softball Congress World Tournament no less than four times in a 10-year span from 1986 through 1995. More than 30 inductees into the Iowa ASA Hall of Fame, Amick included, either played or managed at Hubbard. The name honors a pioneer attorney, Ashel Wheeler Hubbard, from 1819 to 1879, who also lived on in the community of Hubbard, Nebraska. One of the youngest in attendance was another of those state ASA Hall of Famers, pitcher Pete Sandman, a 1978 Bishop Heelan grad. Sandman's career, as many recall, included his contributions to the four ISC World Titles and four ASA National Crowns won by Penn Court teams that won the last three of those eight championships under the name DHCD, National Healthcare Discounters. I got to see this from a different perspective, said Sandman. I grew up literally at Hubbard Park. Our house was at 2814 Jennings Street. As a kid, I'd go up there and play softball every day. I'd go watch these guys play, and they were all my heroes. When someone remembers me as a guy from Penn Court Park, I say, no, I'm from Hubbard Park. Hubbard's early years encompassed the entire career of Francis Foley, a 96-year-old whose pitching exploits got him inducted into the Iowa ASA Hall in 2009. Hubbard was the place to be, said Foley. I was 16 years old when I started. If you played over at Gilman Terrace, you were just playing. But if you were playing at Hubbard, there was electricity in there and it was my favorite place. John Egge, a multi-sport star at Old Central High, wound up punctuating his athletic career with many years as a world-class softball shortstop. One of the whopping 13 ISC Hall of Famers who were involved in the Penn Core NHCD dynasty, Eggy modestly deferred most of his remarks to his three fellow Iowa ASA Hall of Fame performers who also contributed to the Hubbard celebration. I was a young kid, 15 or 16 years old, and I'd go up to Hubbard Park and watch Gene pitch and Smitty catch, said Eggy, referring to pitcher Gene Knopp and catcher Rich Smith, both Ida Grove natives. There were several games when Smith was hurt or sick and he wouldn't leave the game. He had a big heart and so much guts. Eggy also offered one of the event's most humorous anecdotes. He said, one story I'd like to tell is about my buddy, Larry Hellman. He's umping behind home plate, and I was playing shortstop. Somebody hit a ball to the outfield, and the relay throw was to me. I went to home plate, and Larry said the guy was safe. I said, he was out, Larry. He says, no, he wasn't out. And I had a softball in my hand and threw it down on the ground. Larry says, you're out of here. I say, what do you mean? And he says, you were trying to hit me. So I say, how many years did you play with me? If I wanted to hit you, I'd have hit you, he says. Okay, you're back in the game. Pitcher Kevin Spider Smith was a longtime Hubbard mainstay, and he offered plenty of amusing tales. I was probably the worst pitcher in the history of Hubbard Park, said Smith, who recalled facing slugger Jim Phillips. He came up against me, and he hit one over the house, a cozy 201-foot right field line, left a neighboring home in harm's way, to be sure. I asked Phillips why he looked at the first two pitches. He said, the first one I looked at the spin and thought it was going up. The second one I thought was going to go down. And then I realized you were dazzling me with your nothing ball. That short right field porch, incidentally, was altered around 1980 when a 30-foot fence was added. One more Iowa Hall of Famer on the panel was Stan Wisniewski, who will enter his 50th year as a softball umpire in September. It was a distinguished group that included several more long-timers from Hubbard, along with two decorated female pitchers who were a year apart at East High and both won All-American laurels in the college ranks. Jamie Monkey Zidza and Jessica Jones Sitzman, the Morningside College softball coach who also runs the SYA program at Riverside Park. Knopp was one of many who shared memories and admiration for pitcher Leroy Carlson, one of Iowa HOF honorees who is no longer with us. It would have been all the more enjoyable for this gathering to have included Carlson and also Steve Boog McGuire with the recently deceased Steve Zediker. We can't bring back the past, of course, and the men's fast pitch game has faded from the sports menu around here. I only hope respect for the rich contributions the game provided so many of us will live on for several decades to come. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, July 21st. I'm Dogner, your reader for the past hour. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Iris Irish Iris. Short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers. From Dubuque. Don Dweebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers, he told me. I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library. While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers' strategy. Just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play. From famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checkers' strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Duber, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training, Don said he unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. It's like the Mona Lisa, Mr. Checker said, of his museum. You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dweebar. If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.